Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton, the embodiment of the ideal but practical Christian ruler. He was the truth teller, described as a brave, resourceful, pious man. Despite his legacy being warped by Victorian and contemporary accounts, his achievements remain visible and profound. They allowed his son and grandsons to build on his political and military initiatives to unite England under the rule of one king. This is Alfred. In 410 AD, the Romans departed Britain for the final time. It marked the beginning of the so-called Dark Ages, nicknamed due to the lack of factual evidence. As the legions retreated, Britons were left vulnerable. Roman villas, theatres, and temples fell into ruin, and infrastructure into disrepair. Londinium was abandoned. Vortigern became the most prominent leader in the years following the Roman withdrawal. He invited Saxons to come to Britain to help restore order on the embattled, divided island. The Saxons soon rebelled and became the chief cause of the mischief, backfiring on Vortigern. In the following decades, more Saxons, Angles and Jutes began to settle on British shores, sailing from modern-day Germany and Denmark, driving the Britons westward, eventually to Cornwall, and westward of the River Severn in Wales. In the lands they conquered, Roman Christianity was eradicated. Fledgling kingdoms began to emerge. A heptarchy emerged, ruled by seven kingdoms. The heptarchy stretched from the east of the Severn, south of Hadrian's Wall, and the Devon border. East Anglia, Mercia, and Northumbria were ruled by Angles. Essex, Sussex, and Wessex were ruled by Saxons, and Kent was ruled by Jutes. There were many minor kingdoms during this period, which were naturally conquered and absorbed. Yet there was little sense of nations. People were ruled by Saxon warlords, who for the most part were illiterate, marauding pagans. Until around the 8th century, a particularly strong and powerful ruler would claim overlordship of one or more kingdoms. They were known as Bretwalders. They included Offa of Mercia and Ecgbert of Wessex during the kingdom's respective dominant periods. The departure of the Romans also saw the decline of Christianity. The Anglo-Saxons were pagans. In the 580s, Pope Gregory sent over his first Christian missionaries to Kent under St. Augustine, who would become the first Archbishop of Canterbury. Ethelbert of Kent became the very first Anglo-Saxon to convert to Christianity. Missionaries became bishops as more and more arrived on Saxon shores to spread the word of God. Christianity would spread slowly across Britain over the next few centuries. By 690, there were 14 territorial bishoprics under Canterbury. The Whitby Synod in 664 determined that certain Roman customs would be observed specifically around observing the monastic tonsure and the date of Easter. This eventually led to the Romanisation of the church, first in Northumbria and then the rest of Britain. This would last for nearly 900 years. The second half of the 8th century saw Offa of Mercia become the most powerful ruler of the Anglo-Saxons and became the first individual to claim the title King of the English. However, his dynasty fell apart upon his death. A lack of continuity meant the kingdoms would not be unified. By the 9th century, the smaller kingdoms had been permanently absorbed into the larger kingdoms. Cornwall had also been brought under the sovereignty of Wessex. This left four: East Anglia, Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex. Following Offa's death, there was a shift in ascendancy, this time south to Wessex. Alfred was born in around 849 in Wantage in the kingdom of Wessex. He was the son of King Athelwulf and Osbeth. He was the youngest of six children. Four were boys: Athelstan, Athelbald, Athelbert, and Athelred. He also had a sister, Athelswitch. It meant Alfred was very unlikely to become king. Alfred experienced poor health as a child, and it was feared he would not reach adulthood. As a young man, Alfred found it difficult to abstain from carnal desire and feared God's displeasure, so asked to be afflicted by a disease to suppress his lust. As is recorded, God obliged and gave him hemorrhoids. He suffered terribly for many years, and some believed he would not reach adulthood. Illness would plague him for the rest of his life. As a four-year-old, Alfred was sent to Rome to meet Pope Leo IV. The Pope wrote to the king, "We have now graciously received your son Alfred, whom you were anxious to send at this time to the thresholds of the holy apostles, and we have decorated him as a spiritual son with the dignity of the belt and the vestments of the consulate, as is customary with the Roman consuls." None of Alfred's brothers were granted this experience. He returned when he was seven in 856 alongside his father, the king, who left his two sons, Athelbald and Athelbert, to rule in his stead. It has been suggested that the trip to Rome was done to prevent one of his brothers forcing a clerical career on Alfred when they ascended to the throne. The impression left on Alfred accounted for his particular devotion and maturity. Most importantly, Alfred saw this papal investiture as a predestination, and that the Pope had anointed him a future king. Alfred and King Athelwulf spent time in the court of Charles the Bald, King of the Franks. It was there that Athelwulf, who was now widowed, married Charles's daughter, 13-year-old Judith of Flanders. When Athelwulf's heir, Athelbald, heard the news, he grew angry and fearful that he would be replaced. As father and son returned to Wessex in 856, King Athelwulf discovered that he had been overthrown by his son Athelbald. To avoid civil war, a compromise was reached, and Wessex was split, with Athelbald ruling the west and his father Athelwulf ruling the east of the kingdom. Athelwulf died 2 years later, and Athelbald became the outright ruler and the king of Wessex. Four of Athelwulf's sons would then rule in succession: Athelbald, 858 to 860, Athelbert, 860 to 865, and Athelred, 865 to 871, before finally Alfred took the crown. Following the death of Athelwulf, King Athelbald made the controversial decision to marry his father's widow, Judith. This caused a great scandal, as it was forbidden by the church and was called a disgrace by many contemporaries. Judith may well have agreed to avoid the standard fate of widows, being sent to a convent. Athelbald was keen to enhance his status through his marriage to a Carolingian. Athelbald died in 860. Contemporary monk John Asser described him as iniquitous, and his reign is 2.5 lawless years. He was succeeded by younger brother Athelbert. In contrast, it was a rule characterised by good harmony and peace. The description must have referred to internal affairs, for there remained a serious external threat. He too died in 865, a year that proved grave indeed for the Saxon kingdoms. 5 decades prior, the island of Lindisfarne, the sacred heart of the Northumbrian kingdom, was attacked by mysterious pagan raiders. According to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, in this year, fierce, foreboding omens came over the land and the wretched people shook. There were excessive whirlwinds, lightning and fiery dragons were seen flying to the sky in the year of the attack on Lindisfarne. The heathens poured out the blood of saints around the altar and trampled the body of the saints in the temple of God, like dung in the streets. They were Vikings, and this was just the beginning. Saxons were helpless in resisting innumerable raids on their lands and monasteries. The Vikings used navigable rivers to delve deep into the Four Kingdoms and beyond. They would also sail to the continent and raid Paris, to Constantinople, and further east, where they founded the Kievan Rus. After decades of devastating raids, the Vikings changed tact. Saxon kingdoms now faced an existential threat. Where previously they had sought only to raid, in 865, the first year of the reign of 18-year-old Athelred, the great heathen army, led by Ragnar Lothbrok and sons Ivar the Boneless and Uba, invaded East Anglia with the intention of conquering the four Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. They successfully conquered Northumbria 2 years later. Their king, Aela, was executed, supposedly through the method of a blood eagle, his ribs severed from the spine with a sharp tool, and his lungs pulled through the opening to create a pair of wings. The Northumbrian town of York, now named Jorvik, became a crucial Viking trading post. In 871, King Edmund of East Anglia was also executed as his kingdom ceased. His body was used for archery practice as he refused to renounce his Christian faith. He was canonized, and the town of Bury St. Edmunds named in his honor. Two of the four Saxon kingdoms were now occupied. The Vikings installed their own rulers. They'd also set sights on Mercia, taking the town of Nottingham, and Wessex, taking the town of Reading. Alfred joined his brother on the battlefield. Many thousands were slain. Battles were slow, bloody games of attrition. The Vikings held the fields at Reading, Basing, and then Marden. The occupiers were settling. They intermarried. They carved the land into districts, the legacy of which can be found in place names ending in Thorpe, Bee, and Gill. Instead of land divided into Saxon hundreds, they were divided into weapon stakes and ridings. The boroughs were established at Lincoln, Stamford, Nottingham, Derby, and Leicester, stretching from the Tees to the Thames. In 868, 18-year-old Alfred went to the aid of King Burghred in neighbouring Mercia to keep the Vikings at bay. So far, conquest had been routine. When they reached Wessex, they faced a real challenge. In 870, a Viking army was gathering at Reading. Alfred and King Athelred, joined by Mercian reinforcements, launched a frontal attack on the Viking base. They were routed. The brothers desperately fled, crisscrossing the Thames, meeting their depleted forces on the Ridgeway in modern-day Berkshire. The Viking scouts returned, and they smelt blood. On the 8th of January, 871, they assaulted the Saxons in the Battle of Ashdown. When the attack was launched, King Athelred was at prayer in his tent and refused to leave until finished. Alfred seized the moment and led his men, like a wild boar, up the hill to meet the Vikings head on. Finally, the king joined the battle and the Vikings were defeated. It was reported that the whole breadth of Ashdown was covered in bodies. It was a victory, but in reality, a reprieve. They lost subsequent battles, and in April, King Athelred was badly wounded in battle and died of his injuries. 871 had been a desperate year for Wessex, a year that had seen 9 earls and 1 king slain. Never before nor since had 4 brothers succeeded each other on the same throne, and all inside 10 years. It was now Alfred's turn. Alfred succeeded his brother. Despite Athelred having 2 sons, they were underage. A deal had previously been reached between the brothers, and Alfred's succession most likely went uncontested. This was due to the desperate situation Wessex found itself in. The crown passing to a proven commander rather than a child, seemed the logical choice. Under a cloud of despair and anguish, with news reaching Wessex, in 868, Alfred married Aelswych, the daughter of a Mercian nobleman. Together, they would have 5 or 6 children. On the night of his wedding day, Alfred was struck by a severe and mysterious ailment. Some blamed the devil, others blamed witchcraft. It has been suggested that he was probably suffering from Crohn's disease. The timing also suggests it may have been psychologically triggered. It was a terrible disease for a king who spent his life in the saddle. By the year of Alfred's accession, Northumbria and East Anglia had fallen. They were to be followed by Mercia, following the fall of Repton. Their king of 22 years, Burghred, fled into exile in 872, along with Queen Athelswich, Alfred's sister. He was replaced by King Ceolwulf, a Viking stooge. He swore oaths to the Vikings and vowed to be ready at the enemy's service. Alfred faced a military crisis. Wessex was the last Saxon kingdom standing. By promoting himself as the defender of all Christian Anglo-Saxon kingdoms against the heathens, he paved the way for the future unity of all England. A month after his accession, Alfred's men suffered another defeat against an irresistible Viking army at Wilton. Alfred attempted to buy the Vikings off. Saxon coin had become so debased that instead the Vikings settled for a vast amount of valuable items, such as rings, sword pommels, chalices and crosses, in exchange for leaving Wessex alone. As the Vikings departed to their London base for winter, Alfred would have known the best he could hope for was a temporary reprieve. Wessex was weak. Viking infighting meant the reprieve actually lasted until 875. Then Alfred's luck ran out. Guthrum became Alfred's most noted adversary, with his determination to conquer Wessex. By the end of 877, many Viking leaders had become preoccupied with ruling instead of plundering. They had been dividing territory in Northumbria, East Anglia, and Mercia, ploughing the land and supporting themselves. Yet in January 878, a heathen army stealthily approached Chippenham on the last day of Christmas. It was common for Vikings to attack Christians during festivities to catch them off guard. Wessex suffered a terrible military defeat. Many fled overseas as the hosts were overwhelmed. The Vikings would hold Chippenham for 5 months. To survive, Guthrum ordered the plundering of the surrounding villages. It was an excellent strategic base. It was well supplied, with communication lines from which to conquer the whole of Wessex. Alfred was forced to flee to Athelney, to the woods and fens of Somerset. Though contrary to pro-Alfred accounts, he was not alone. Yes, he had with him a small band of nobles and thanes, the Saxon equivalent of a knight, but also pockets of resistance hidden in forests around his kingdom. Alfred remained hidden for 6 months. The West Saxons resorted to hit-and-run tactics, seizing supplies where they could, moving with difficulty through dense forests and marshes. Here, the likely apocryphal story involving Alfred and some cakes supposedly took place. So far, the king had fallen. He was residing in the cottage of a swineherd. One day, the swineherd put some loaves in the oven and went out to work. She came home to find her houseguest mending his bow and arrows, the smell attracting her to the burnt loaves. Alfred received a royal telling off when she returned. "You hesitate to turn the loaves you see to be burning, yet you're happy to eat them when they come warm from the oven." Meanwhile, Alfred was communicating with other aldermen in exile across the beleaguered kingdom. In Lynmouth, Devon, under the alderman Odder, A heroic struggle saw 840 Vikings killed, including their leader, Ubba. Guthrum had lost his reinforcements. It spurred Alfred into action. He built his own fortress, surrounded by swampy, impassable marshes, only accessible by punt. Finally, in May, Alfred returned to the open. He successfully organised a rendezvous with other aldermen across Wiltshire, Somerset and Hampshire. They met at his grandfather Egbert's stone. He now had a force with which to launch a counterattack. The timing was symbolic. The seventh week of Easter, according to Asser, as if one is restored to life after suffering such great tribulations. Guthrum had since moved his base to Edington. Before the break of dawn, on the 9th of May, 878, Alfred's army moved under the steep chalk edge of Salisbury Plain. Then the band of bold men was quickly made ready. Brave in battle, warriors marched out and bore banners of victory. Heroes beneath their helmets, at the break of dawn, their shields rang. According to Asser, Alfred destroyed the pagans with great slaughter, hacking them down, and pursued those who fled as far as a stronghold, the Viking base at Chippenham. There, they were besieged for 14 days. They were brought to the depths of despair and hunger, cold and fear. They surrendered. The Vikings agreed to humiliating terms, giving up many hostages. Alfred gave up none. Never had the Vikings surrendered so much. It was one of the most important and consequential victories in English history. Though accounts are almost all pro-Alfred, some historians have viewed the accounts as effective propaganda. The conditions of battle have been viewed as impossible. That is, distress and the Fens of Somerset were exaggerated in order to create the Alfred myth. However, it is without a doubt that Edington turned the tide. Wessex would be safe. Guthrum, along with 30 Viking warriors, converted to Christianity, with Alfred becoming Guthrum's godfather, the first time a Viking leader had agreed to do so in Britain. Previously, the Vikings had been so difficult to control and predict due to their dismissal of Christian rules. By being baptised, Guthrum accepted a level of subordination. Guthrum, through investing in Alfred, could guarantee land for himself. The Treaty of Wedmore drew the lines between territories belonging to Alfred and Guthrum. Mercia would be partitioned. The boundary between the English and the Danes went up the River Thames, the River Lee to Bedford, up the River Ouse to Watling Street. Beyond this line would be Viking territory. Scandinavian law was enacted, and hence this part of England would become known as the Danelaw. Guthrum upheld his end of the treaty and eventually began settling in East Anglia instead. The final Saxon kingdom had been on the brink of collapse. Had Wessex fallen, all Saxon kingdoms would have become part of a Scandinavian confederacy. The entire history of England could have been rather different. Perhaps the Vikings would have resisted the Norman conquest a few centuries later. Alfred's territory included the Mercian capital, London. There is some suggestion that Alfred seized London by force in 883 in order to remove the Viking puppet Ceolwulf. Alfred organised the marriage between his daughter, Æthelflæd, and the Mercian lord called Æthelred, in order to draw a line under these divisions and create a lasting union. Alfred's intentions were clear. Charters now called him King of the Anglo-Saxons. All Christians, except under subjection to the Danes, submitted to him. He never claimed that Mercia had been absorbed into Wessex. Instead, he claimed unity through common ethnicity. A new coinage now bore the legend Rex Anglo, and Alfred began signing charters, King of the Anglo-Saxons. Alfred now took steps to use relative peace constructively. In 893, Alfred reformed the Fyrd, an Anglo-Saxon army formed from freemen or paid men to defend their shire's lord's estate or the king. Now they would be divided. Half would always remain at home, working, and half would remain on active service. A standing army would serve 6 months per year. This gave Wessex protection and production. While Guthrum maintained peace with Wessex, this did not stop other Viking armies trying their luck. To counter Danish plundering of the southern coast, Alfred built many more ships. Some historians have argued he is the true father of the Royal Navy. These longships would now have 60 oars. Alfred's own design, manned by Danish mercenaries. His longships recorded victories over Viking raiders, including the destruction of 250 ships off the coast of Kent in 892. Alfred built a chain of burhs, fortified towns, no more than 20 miles apart, equipped with ramparts. They were built around his kingdom, stretching from Devon to Sussex. They proved immune to future Danish attacks. Each burh would be supported quickly by neighbours if attacked. This improved the Wessex economy and allowed his citizens to live and work in peace. Some of these burhs still exist today, most notably Wareham, whose banks were pressed back into service as anti-tank ditches in 1940. Now with control of London, Alfred worked to repair what was England's most important trading hub. It was repopulated. His street plan still survives between Cheapside and the Thames. The network of lanes remained unchanged until the Great Fire of London in 1666. Alfred also replanned his capital, Winchester, on a Roman grid pattern, which survives to this day. Although recent archaeological evidence suggests it was planned by his predecessors, nevertheless, he was adamant that the city needed to rival the great courts of Europe. Alfred worked to scrap various punishments and customs in the legal system. One widespread custom was to receive a judgment by ordeal. For example, someone accused of a crime might be made to eat a specifically baked cake. If they were lying, God would ensure they would choke to death. There was also ordeal by fire. This saw the accused plunge his arm into boiling water to fetch a stone. The arm would be bandaged. In 3 days, if the burns had healed, then he would be acquitted. Alfred issued a new legal code based on those of Ethelbert of Kent and Offa of Mercia. Those he liked anyway. Some were odd, but well-meaning. If a man is killed by a fallen tree, the tree should belong to the family. He limited practice of the blood feud by imposing heavy penalties for breached oaths and pledges. Kings were to be protected from treason, but in return had to ensure law was enforced and security maintained. This was an early stirring of the principle of consent to rule. He encouraged the use of local courts, where jurors would be familiar with the person accused, to make informed judgments. The principle that one of the best guides to who was telling the truth was the good name, or the less good name, that a man enjoyed among his neighbours. The modern principle would of course be the exact opposite. The decline in learning over the past century had been a result of Viking destruction, particularly the monasteries and nunneries that had been central to the education system. This can be seen in manuscripts of the period, written by bishops, suggesting a poor understanding of Latin. This encouraged Alfred to introduce a new education system. He invited scholars from Europe and from Mercia to teach in church schools with the aim to make England literate. Schooling would begin in English to build the foundations with Latin introduced later. All young freemen of adequate means were required to learn to read English. English literacy would help create an English identity, crucial to Alfred's ultimate goal. While English was already the language used for administrative documents, such as charters and law codes, it had never been employed for great works of literature, philosophy, or theology. Alfred compiled a list of books deemed most necessary for all men to know. Alfred, with his team of scholars, had begun the process of translating books into English. Alfred, by this point an older man, learned Latin in order to do this. The translations included Pope Gregory I's Pastoral Care, The History Against All Pagans, and The Ecclesiastical History of the English People. A few original translations survive in the Bodleian Library in Oxford and the British Library in London. The translations allowed English to become a language of prose literature and guaranteed its survival. It also crucially promoted the idea of Englishness. It persuaded Alfred to commission his own work of history in order to showcase this common identity. This was the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Crucially, the project continued after Alfred's death. The Chronicle would be actively updated until the mid-12th century. Unlike his Saxon forebears, Alfred was subject to a full-length biography written by his friend, Welsh scholar Asser. This fascinating close-up view of the king was not afforded to other Saxon rulers. It also provided vital information of major events during his rule for future historians, even if he is projected in an almost entirely positive light. In 892, 80 Viking ships landed at the east end of the Forest of Andre. From there, they occupied the village of Milton Regis in Kent. 250 more landed in Athelthor in North Devon. Alfred ensured the two armies could not be united, and their leader Heston agreed to terms. His two sons were baptized. Instead, Heston looked to raid Mercia. According to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, after many weeks had passed, some of the heathens died of hunger. But some, having then eaten their horses, broke out of the fortress and joined battle with those who were on the east bank of the river. But when many thousands of pagans had been slain and all the others had been put to flight, the Christians were masters of the place of death. Alfred's Burs had proven consequential in repelling the final Viking attack of Alfred's reign. There is very little reporting of Alfred's final years after the conclusion of the war in 896. Alfred died on the 26th of October, 899, after 26 years on the throne. He was around 50 years old. The cause of death is unknown, but likely caused by one of his lifelong ailments. His body was taken for burial in the Royal Burgh of Winchester. Historian Patrick Warmold wrote, "It is needless to endorse all that has been thought of Alfred as history transmuted into myth. The historical record plainly establishes that he was among the most remarkable rulers in the annals of human government. His reputation grew during the Victorian era as a role model for everyone, with plaudits also highlighting his personal achievements. He was subject to plays, novels, paintings, songs and poems, much of which were modern inventions, Charles Dickens called him England's greatest king, as great and good in peace as he was great and good at war. King Alfred never rested from his labours to improve his people. He loved to talk with clever men and with travellers from foreign countries, and to write down what they told him for his people to read. He founded schools. He patiently heard causes of himself in the court of justice. The great desires of his heart were to do right to all of his subjects and to leave England better, wiser, happier in all ways than he found it. He had his detractors. The author of the Abingdon Chronicle described him as a Judas, piling one bad debt on top of another, who stripped the monasteries of their land and violently alienated their estates. He did not hear his own epithet during his lifetime. It was with the 1709 biography entitled Alfred the Great that it became truly popular, the only English king to be given the honour. Had he stayed in the fens and swamps of Somerset or fled abroad, the nation of England may never have been formed. But perhaps it is what he did after his great victory at Edington which raises him to the ranks of greatness. He added a new dimension to kingship. He revolutionised towns, the military, education, with shrewdness and ruthless determination, even under the constant threat of the Danes. It allowed the expansion of Wessex and the eventual development of an English state. Thank you for listening. It's good to be back. Join us next time for Edward the Elder. If you would like to get in touch, send in a question. As always, you can send an email to thekingsandqueenspodcast@gmail.com. We're on Instagram, Kings Queens Podcast. We're on Twitter or X, Kings Queens Pod. And we're on Facebook as well. Please send in your questions, and I'll see you next time.